In a world increasingly dominated by corporate media conglomerates and government propaganda, Amy Goodman's Static stands as a defiant beacon of journalistic integrity. Published during the height of the Iraq War, this explosive exposé became an instant New York Times bestseller, resonating with readers hungry for unfiltered truth. Celebrities from Susan Sarandon to Michael Moore have championed Goodman's fearless reporting, while her daily program, Democracy Now!, has grown from a small radio show to a multimedia phenomenon broadcast on over 500 stations worldwide. What makes this book particularly compelling is its timing. Released when mainstream media was at its most compliant with power, Static dared to document the machinery of deception operating at the highest levels of government and media. As one reviewer noted, in an era when journalists were either embedded with troops or in bed with power, Goodman remained defiantly unembedded. The Bush administration's propaganda apparatus extended far beyond Iraq, operating as a sophisticated psychological warfare operation targeting both foreign and domestic audiences. Despite legal prohibitions against using foreign propaganda on American citizens, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld dismissed these concerns with chilling candor. "When you speak today, there's no one audience." Pentagon briefings explicitly identified the American home audience as targets for information warfare. This propaganda machine worked with remarkable efficiency. In Iraq, U.S. officials planted stories in local newspapers with headlines like, "Iraqi Army Defeats Terrorism," alongside articles claiming Iraqi security forces were a viable fighting force, even as military leaders privately acknowledged no Iraqi battalions could operate independently. Meanwhile, the administration deliberately inflated Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's role to falsely connect Saddam Hussein with 9/11 and portray the insurgency as foreign-led. "Villainize Zarqawi, leverage xenophobia response," stated one military briefing with stunning frankness. When U.S. psychological operations officers leaked a supposed Zarqawi letter to the New York Times, General Mark Kimmett later boasted it was the most successful information campaign to date. The government's information war included tracking journalists' phone calls to identify whistleblowers, with Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez threatening prosecution for publishing classified information. The message was unmistakable. Either participate in the administration's narrative or become its target. Why did this propaganda succeed? Because the corporate media, compromised by its own complicity in promoting administration lies, abandoned its watchdog role. Celebrity journalists like Judith Miller and Bob Woodward, once crusading reporters, became willing conduits for government disinformation. For 3 years, the New York Times danced to the administration's tune, with Miller's dispatches serving as a conveyor belt for fabrications from Iraqi exiles connected to the CIA-created Iraqi National Congress. Have you ever wondered why certain perspectives dominate our news while others remain invisible? The answer lies in what media critics call the access of evil. Journalists trading truth for access, creating an illusion of balanced coverage that viewers mistake for reality. Today's corporate media suffers from a fundamental corruption. Journalists trade truth for access, creating an illusion of news that viewers mistake for reality. This extends to the one-sided debates dominating network and cable news. During Bush's first term, 69% of journalists appearing on Sunday shows were conservatives, and 58% of all guests were Republicans. In the critical months before the Iraq invasion, less than 1% of experts appearing on major networks represented anti-war organizations. This isn't mainstream media, it's extreme media that cheerleads for war while marginalizing dissent. Instead of learning what's actually happening, we get static, a veil of distortion, lies, omissions, and half-truths obscuring reality. As bodies piled up in Iraq and New Orleans, many wondered where journalism had gone wrong. The New York Times' handling of its NSA wiretapping story perfectly illustrates this surrender of journalistic independence. In December 2005, The Times published James Risen and Eric Lichtblau's explosive report revealing the Bush administration's illegal wiretapping of U.S. citizens. But buried in the ninth paragraph was an astonishing admission. The Times had delayed publication for a full year at the White House's request, meaning they withheld this vital information until after Bush's 2004 re-election. Editor Bill Keller's explanation defied journalistic principles. Administration officials had assured Times editors that legal checks were in place, this from the same regime that had declared torture, preemptive war, and offshore gulags legal. The story was finally published only because Risen planned to reveal it in an upcoming book, forcing the paper's hand. What we need instead is media that creates static of another kind: criticism, opposition, or unwanted interference. People aren't waiting for corporate media to reform. They're building this alternative media now through blogs, independent media centers, and citizen journalism. Democracy Now! Exemplifies this tradition, bringing forth dissidents, activists, whistleblowers, and those most affected by power's decisions. With lives and freedoms at stake, we need fiercely independent journalism that informs rather than deceives. Mahar Arar's nightmare began innocently enough. The 33-year-old Canadian computer engineer was changing planes at JFK Airport when he was detained, interrogated for hours without legal counsel, and repeatedly denied his rights because he wasn't an American citizen. Despite his desperate protests that he would be tortured if sent to Syria, U.S. officials ignored him. They chained him, flew him on a CIA torture taxi to Jordan, where he was beaten, then delivered him to Syrian authorities. In Syria, he was brutally tortured with cable beatings and imprisoned in what he described as an underground grave, a cell just 3 feet wide, 6 feet deep, and 7 feet high, with rats and no proper sanitation. He remained in this torture chamber for over 10 months. After Canadian government intervention, Arar was finally released without charges in October 2003. Years later, he still suffers nightmares, fears flying, and struggles with the terrorist label that destroyed his career. "I never thought human beings could treat other human beings like that," he reflected. Arar wasn't an isolated case, but part of a systematic program called Extraordinary Rendition that began under Clinton but expanded dramatically after 9/11. Hundreds of suspects were kidnapped globally and sent to countries known for torture. When Arar sued U.S. officials, including John Ashcroft and FBI Director Robert Mueller, Judge David Trager dismissed the case, ruling that even decisions leading to torture are most appropriately reserved to the executive and legislative branches when national security is involved. This judicial capitulation prompted Center for Constitutional Rights President Michael Ratner to observe that the idea of torture as legitimate was seeping into not just the administration and the executive, but into the judiciary. As Arar himself noted, when a court will not act because of national security, there is no longer any difference between the West and the Third World. The CIA's Extraordinary Rendition program operated with shocking impunity. In Milan, Italy, CIA agents kidnapped Egyptian cleric Hassan Mustafa Osama Nasr, Abu Ammar, off the street in broad daylight. While the agents lived lavishly in luxury hotels, Abu Ammar was subjected to brutal torture in Egypt. The CIA deliberately misled Italian authorities about his whereabouts, claiming he had fled to the Balkans. Italian prosecutors eventually issued arrest warrants for 22 CIA operatives, marking the first time a foreign government attempted to prosecute U.S. intelligence agents. When Washington Post reporter Donna Priest exposed the CIA's secret prison network in Eastern Europe, her newspaper withheld the specific countries involved at the request of senior U.S. officials. This decision to withhold crucial information drew criticism from media watchdogs who argued that exposing abuse is precisely what a free press should do. The consequences of such media complicity are not theoretical. In 1961, both the New Republic and the New York Times withheld crucial information about the CIA's planned Bay of Pigs invasion at the Kennedy administration's request. After the disastrous operation left 114 invaders dead and nearly 1,200 captured, President Kennedy himself lamented, "If you had printed more about the operation, you would have saved us from a colossal mistake." In 1971, during another era of government deception and an unpopular foreign war, anonymous activists calling themselves the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI broke into an FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania, stealing over 1,000 documents. These were mailed to various news outlets, revealing the existence of COINTELPRO, the FBI's counterintelligence program designed to neutralize domestic political groups. Despite Attorney General John Mitchell's pressure to suppress the story, the Washington Post published the revelations, exposing how the FBI recruited local officials to spy on campus and black activist groups. 3 decades later, the federal government has resumed spying on innocent Americans exercising their free speech rights. Sarah Bardwell experienced this firsthand when FBI agents and Denver police in SWAT gear showed up at her door in 2004, claiming to be investigating suspected terrorists regarding potential actions at upcoming political conventions. When Bardwell and her roommates declined to answer questions, agents took notes on items in their home and threatened more intrusive effort for their non-cooperation. 2 years later, she admitted, "We don't talk about politics anymore. There's been a toning down of everything we do." The Thomas Merton Center in Pittsburgh became a target of an FBI international terrorism investigation simply for opposing the Iraq War. Secret FBI files obtained by the ACLU revealed the center was monitored for handing out anti-war leaflets, with one memo noting that an activist appeared to be of Middle Eastern descent. Tim Vining, the center's former director, explained they were targeted for trying to build relationships with the Muslim community. Pentagon spies even infiltrated a meeting at a Quaker meeting house in Florida, where activists were planning a protest against military recruiters in high schools. This surveillance was part of a secret Pentagon database tracking threats, which monitored dozens of peaceful anti-war protests, including demonstrations by military families. The most far-reaching surveillance program was the NSA's warrantless eavesdropping, exposed by the New York Times in December 2005, after the paper had withheld the story for over a year at the White House's request. AT&T whistleblower Mark Klein revealed the company built secret eavesdropping rooms in their main switching centers. NSA whistleblower Russell Tice explained that bypassing the FISA court suggested the program was a lot bigger than acknowledged, likely a vacuum cleaner approach. Despite administration claims that the program saved thousands of lives, virtually all NSA tips led to dead ends or innocent Americans, with FBI agents joking that new domestic terrorism tips meant more calls to Pizza Hut. As Russell Tice, a lifelong Republican who voted for Bush, warned Congress, "The freedom of the American people cannot be protected when our constitutional liberties are ignored and our nation has decayed into a police state." By 2006, the Bush administration faced numerous scandals, policy failures, and PR disasters, from the Iraq quagmire to Hurricane Katrina's devastation. With 70% of Americans disapproving of their president, the administration turned to propaganda, spending $1.6 billion on advertising and public relations between 2003 to 2005 to promote its policies. Creating the illusion of a free Iraqi media was a priority. The Pentagon paid the Lincoln Group to plant propaganda in Iraqi newspapers, while the U.S.-backed Al-Sabah newspaper became a dangerous place for Iraqi journalists to work. Staff received death threats and faced bombing attempts, eventually walking out in protest over lack of editorial independence. The Harris Corporation, which landed the media contract despite little journalism experience, had strong Republican Party ties and donated heavily to GOP candidates. Meanwhile, the Pentagon's propaganda campaign violated its own directive prohibiting psychological operations targeting U.S. media.
In one instance, a Marine spokesperson appeared on CNN announcing a Fallujah invasion that wouldn't begin for weeks, an elaborate psychological operation. The Iraqi National Congress, paid $340,000 monthly by the Defense Department, planted false stories about WMDs and fabricated a meeting between Saddam Hussein and bin Laden. Domestically, the Bush administration created an alternate reality through fake television news segments distributed to local stations. Government agencies spent $250 million producing hundreds of these segments, featuring pseudo-reporters delivering propaganda about Medicare, the Transportation Security Administration, and the Iraq War. The Government Accountability Office labeled these covert propaganda and declared them illegal, but the White House instructed agencies to disregard these findings. The propaganda extended to paying pundits. Armstrong Williams received $240,000 to promote the No Child Left Behind Act, promising to be a one-stop propaganda shop delivering favorable commentaries. Columnist Maggie Gallagher received $41,500 from HHS and the Justice Department to promote Bush's marriage initiatives while writing supportive columns without disclosure. Conservative columnist Mike McCanis got $10,000 for similar work. When real journalists became troublesome, the administration employed fake ones. Jeff Gannon, actually James Gookert, a male escort and webmaster of gay porn sites, obtained White House press credentials before publishing his first article for the Republican-affiliated Talon News GOP USA. At a rare presidential press conference, Bush called on Gannon, who delivered a softball question attacking Democrats. Meanwhile, legitimate journalists faced barriers. New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd was initially denied press credentials, while Helen Thomas, dean of the White House press corps, who had covered presidents since Kennedy, was moved to the back row and rarely called upon after asking challenging questions about Iraq. These propaganda efforts succeeded in confusing the public. A December 2005 Harris poll showed many Americans still believed discredited justifications for invading Iraq. 41% believed Saddam Hussein had strong links to Al-Qaeda, 22% thought he helped plan 9/11, and 26% believed Iraq had WMDs when invaded. Among U.S. troops, 90% believed the mission was to retaliate for Saddam's role in the 9/11 attacks.
The relationship between corporate media and the U.S. government has been systematically cultivated for decades. From the 1950s to the 1970s, over 400 American journalists secretly worked for the CIA in what was sometimes called Operation Mockingbird. At its peak in the 1960s, this propaganda network included more than 800 news organizations and individuals, with America's top media executives willingly participating in the deception. Beyond merely influencing journalists, the CIA created an entire parallel universe of agency-backed media worldwide. The CIA owned or subsidized over 50 media outlets, mostly overseas. The agency employed at least a dozen full-time agents in American news organizations, often with management's knowledge, while another dozen foreign news organizations were infiltrated by paid CIA agents. About 22 American news organizations employed journalists who simultaneously worked for the CIA, and roughly a dozen American publishing houses printed more than 1,000 CIA-produced or subsidized books. Though legally prohibited from disseminating propaganda within the United States, the CIA accepted that some of its disinformation would inevitably reach American audiences as blowback or domestic fallout. Some former employees even admitted that certain propaganda efforts, especially during the Vietnam War, were carried out with their eventual U.S. impact in mind. The mighty Wurlitzer continues operating today, though in evolved forms. Modern journalists, like former New York Times reporter Judith Miller, serve government interests without direct payment. Miller received Pentagon security clearance during the Iraq War that gave her access to classified information but restricted her from discussing sensitive matters with her editors. Her apocalyptic and ultimately false reporting about Iraq's WMDs received prominent placement in America's most influential newspaper. Craig Pies, who worked with Miller on an Al-Qaeda series, complained to Times editors in 2000. She is an advocate. She has turned in a draft that is little more than dictation from government sources, filled with unproven assertions and factual inaccuracies.
As a senior CIA official presciently noted in 1977, the pendulum will swing, and someday we'll be recruiting journalists again. I see a lot of them, and I know they're ripe for the plucking. In times of universal deceit, truth-telling becomes revolutionary. Despite facing war, corruption, and state-sanctioned torture, independent thinkers, activists, and journalists worldwide are speaking truth to power. Democracy Now! Breaks the sound barrier by broadcasting diverse, dissenting voices, from the powerful to the grassroots, the celebrated to the marginalized. Alice Walker, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Color Purple, reflects on her arrest at an anti-Iraq war protest outside the White House. When you're able to gather your own forces and deal with your own fears, and you gather with all of the other people who are just as small as you are, but you're together. Though war may never end externally, Walker sees anti-war activism as crucial for internal peace. What we're trying to do is stop it in ourselves. South African journalist Alistair Sparks, who gained fame exposing apartheid abuses, identifies a critical media problem, the elite consensus, where journalists become embedded with their sources. Senior reporters covering specific beats become part of the elite they report on, socializing with sources, thinking like them, and growing dependent on maintaining access. This dependency makes journalists reluctant to challenge official narratives. The last thing they want to do is give offense to the source by suggesting that the source is not telling the truth. Amira Haas, daughter of a Holocaust survivor and the only Jewish Israeli journalist living in Palestinian territories, explains her decision to immerse herself in occupied communities. "I wanted to experience life under occupation day by day and night by night, not just on visits." Her decade of reporting from Gaza and the West Bank has earned mixed reactions. Some Israelis call her a traitor, while military officials acknowledge her accuracy. Robert Fisk of the London Independent argues that media's refusal to show the true horrors of war enables more conflicts. "If you saw what I saw when I go to wars with civilians or the wounded in hospitals, you would never, ever dream of supporting a war again," he explains. Fisk criticizes how journalists seek proximity to power rather than challenging it, emphasizing journalists must challenge power consistently, even if the politicians and the prime minister, even if your readers hate you. Arundhati Roy, acclaimed Indian author and activist, delivered a powerful speech at Riverside Church in New York 6 weeks after the Iraq invasion. Speaking as a subject of the American Empire, she criticized the U.S. government's self-granted right to wage war at will, using democracy as its sly new war cry. Roy argued that Americans are paying for these liberation wars with their own freedoms. She urged Americans to confront empire by isolating and disabling its working parts, supporting independent media, and joining the battle in millions. "If you join the battle, not in your hundreds of thousands, but in your millions, you will be greeted joyously by the rest of the world. History is giving you the time. Seize the time." The battle for truth in our media landscape continues today with mounting intensity. As corporate consolidation accelerates, with just 6 major conglomerates now controlling 90% of American media, and government propaganda grows more sophisticated through data analytics and targeted messaging, the need for independent, uncompromising journalism has never been more critical. The voices highlighted in Static remind us that challenging power is not just possible, but essential for democracy's survival in an era of information warfare. When journalists trade access for truth, like the widespread self-censorship during the Iraq War, when media companies prioritize profit over public interest through clickbait and sensationalism, when government officials manipulate information with impunity through selective leaks and strategic misinformation, we all lose. The cost is measured not just in misleading headlines, but in eroded public trust and weakened democratic institutions. Yet, the examples of courage throughout this book demonstrate that individuals can make a profound difference. From Edward Snowden exposing mass surveillance programs to Chelsea Manning revealing military misconduct, from independent journalists like Amy Goodman reporting from Standing Rock to citizen journalists documenting police brutality, these are the forces that break through the static of manufactured consent. The digital age has created new challenges, but also new opportunities for truth-telling. Social media platforms can amplify independent voices while simultaneously spreading misinformation. Encryption tools protect sources while surveillance technology threatens them. As we navigate this increasingly complex information environment, perhaps the most important lesson is that media is not something that happens to us, it's something we actively participate in creating. By supporting independent journalism through subscriptions and donations, by questioning official narratives through fact-checking and research, by amplifying marginalized voices through sharing and engagement, and by speaking truth to power in our own communities and workplaces, we contribute to a more democratic media landscape. The static may be loud, amplified by algorithmic echo chambers, corporate interests, and state propaganda, but the truth is louder still. We see this in the impact of investigative reporting that exposes corruption, in viral videos that capture injustice, in grassroots movements that shift public discourse, and in that truth, documented and defended by countless brave individuals, lies our hope for a more just and peaceful world. The future of media depends not on corporate boardrooms or government agencies, but on ordinary people committed to seeking and sharing truth.